This is the podcast for Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. First, a brief announcement, a couple of brief announcements. The first one is that the extra credit exam is open. So if you take it, it will replace either your first or second midterm score or your final, whichever is is lowest. You have to have taken all three exams in order for it to have an effect. So it will replace your lowest score of your three exams, but is not a substitute for any one of them. So it's like a second chance at improving one of your scores. It's based on material from the first two exams, and it'll close Friday of week 10. If you're thinking about changing a grading option or something, I'd encourage you to take it before this Friday. Yeah.
So if you're going to study for the extra credit exam, should you just use both study guides from the previous exams?
Yep. And then you can come by my office. You're allowed one look at the exam in the testing lab by just submitting a blank attempt. And then you can see all the answers. If you want to see which ones you got wrong, if you can't remember, if you want to focus on those, you'll have to come by my office. And I guess that's it for the...
So you can look at the extra credit exam?
No, not the extra credit exam, but you can look at the first and second exams.
Oh, okay, awesome.
So you just go in the testing lab. It'll let you take it again. Just tell them, I want to take this class, or I want to take this test. And then just submit a blank attempt, and then it'll show you all the answers. And so you'll be able to look at all of them.
Oh, yes.
And I may have a few questions in the... So it'll largely be drawn from actual questions of the first and second exam. Yeah.
And how long is it open for?
Until through Friday of week 10 when the lab closes. So basically the last day of school, the last day the lab's open, except for finals. So, but if you'd like to... If you're thinking about whether or not you want to change your grading option, you might want to take it by Friday if you feel like you're ready. You only get one shot at it, so you know, you'll have to make that decision yourself. But if you can, it might help you to take it by this Friday if you're thinking about changing a pass, no pass, or because you might say, hey, you might take it, and it might be that the exam you bombed, the brain, you get like a, you know, an 85 or a 90 or something, you're like, oh, my grade's actually looking pretty good now. So that might be a reason to take it by Friday at 5, which, just as a final reminder, is the last day to change your grading option or to drop the class entirely if you want to withdraw.
And the extra credit exam it's not on top of, it'll replace
the
lowest, right?
Its score will replace your lowest score. If it's lower than any exam that you've taken, it won't hurt you. Right. Don't forget about your form post. There's another one due this Sunday. Form post can't be made up. You can get an extra point added to your form post total by posting the extra credit form in week 10.
Even if you did all 10?
No. So if you did all 10, it won't count.
Oh.
So it's only for the people that missed one. So... And let's see what else. I guess that's it for classroom announcements. The Students for Liberty Club is going to be resurrecting, coming back from the dead. Actually at the end of this term, just had a meeting in the lunchtime. Somebody's going to kick some money towards the club, so we're going to have some kind of big social event. So if you're interested, maybe I'll even circulate a piece of paper, rather than ask people to come to me. So if you're interested in the club, maybe I'll just... Did I take all my paper out? All the... I don't have any paper left. When I do this, I'll... can I get someone to volunteer a piece of paper? And just write Students for Liberty Club. This doesn't obligate you to, you know, come to any of the meetings or whatever. Just if you want to know about it. Maybe put like a place for email address and phone number. Phone number is an option. We'll probably do things via email. And if you're interested, there's a Facebook page, LCC. Oops. here.
It's just LCC, Students for Liberty.
Thank you.
So what is this all about? Well,
you know, being against the establishment, being against the man, not wanting other people to tell you how to lead your life, individual rights, personal responsibility, a voluntary society where people deal with one another as human beings rather than through authoritarianism and having a bureaucrat order people about and telling them what they can do. Telling you you can't take a drink until you're 21, but should there be a war, all the men in the country, you might be drafted, and you know, all the insults to your liberties, small and big, are things that we want to try to change. And so that's going to start. I'm just a faculty advisor, so I'll be sitting on the sidelines. Kibitzing, but this is a student-led group. So a bunch of the leadership went on to the U of O, found jobs, and otherwise left, and I was on sabbatical, so the thing sort of fell into disrepair, and it's looking to come back with a vengeance end of this term. So should be fun stuff. And now we've got some money, so we can actually do even funner stuff. Money is great. Free market capitalism is all about your ability to earn as much money as you like and to give it away to people, as the people who are helping out with the club are doing. Okay, let's get back to philosophy. Pascal. Just kind of pass it around to the next person. Maybe there'll be no names on it. Just like drop it on somebody's desk.
Okay.
Thank you. And maybe it's blank with no names. No interest in liberty. Or everybody's overcommitted or something. So there'll be handbills around campus spring term, too. So Pascal's wager. Pascal, this is a common argument you hear from religious people, right? Let me ask this. Is there anybody who's heard this argument just like from some religious person telling them that they should believe in God? Maybe at least one, two people? Yeah. So when you ask a religious person, why do you believe in God? And they'll say, well, you know, hey, there's no downside to it. Because even if I'm wrong and there isn't a God, look at all this great stuff I got. Look, I'm hedging my bets. Because if there is a God and I don't believe him, he's going to be pissed. And he might send me to hell. And so I got to think about that. And also I think, what harm does it do to believe in God? It sort of, you know, makes me feel better about my life. It gives me hope. It gives me a sense of purpose and meaning. I'm part of a community, so when I go to church and I sing those hymns, I get those warm, fuzzy feelings, and it's you know, it's family values and all this kind of stuff. And it's, you know, it's kind of good for me to be a religious person. It's like, I know these people, they're like lapsed Catholics. All of a sudden, they start having kids. What they do, they start going to church. Or even worse, they like send their kids to the church and they don't go. And why? Because it's going to be good for them. Why? It's going to teach them good moral values. And so there's this idea that religion and morality sort of go together, and it provides like a nice sort of foundation for a person to live their life. And I always wonder what these parents will, if it's so great, how come you're not going? Oh, because it's really boring to sit through, you know. I'll stand up and sit down and sing this hymn and repeat after me. And you're going to the Catholic Church anyway. Some people love the Catholic Church. I find it extremely boring. For me, like if I'm going to go to a religious service, I like the Pentecostal thing. You know, it's, you know, it's sort of libertarian religion, right? It's free form. Anyway, so too many rules in the Catholic Church for me. But the great thing about that is they're voluntary rules. And so nobody's there that doesn't want to be, unless you're a kid under the authority of your parents. So Pascal's wager, a common argument you'll hear for God's existence. Remember, this is a pragmatic argument, which is, what is a pragmatic argument for God's existence? It's an argument. Pragmatic means it's good for you. So it says, even if you can't tell, even though you cannot prove God exists,
to leave. Anyways, because it's good for you. This is how you see this argument on the internet. Right? So, except for maybe without, capitalized I. So even though you can't prove God exists, why should you believe in God anyway? Because it's good for you. Because you're going to win something. It's like, you know, you get a call on the telephone that tells you you've just won a cruise, four nights and 3 days in Hawaii. You know, so
again, two possibilities. God exists. God doesn't exist.
Can anybody think of a third possibility?
Many gods.
Okay, actually, I suppose when you're talking about God, how about God or gods? You raise a good point, which is actually one of the objections. But I just want to go to the point: if the proposition is God exists, that proposition is either true or false. And by God, you sort of define, you know, what you mean by God, the kind of classical Western definition of God, and you say, okay, there is one or there isn't one. There's no in between. Now, you take another proposition like, you know, many gods exist, the same thing there, either true or false. And it could be false because there's not more than one God, there's just one, and it's this God, the sort of Judeo-Christian God. Or it could be that it could be that there's one God, it could be that there's no gods. So there's different ways, but it's still, that proposition is either true or it's false. So we're assuming for the time being anywhere, we're thinking about like a single God, the kind of God of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the God of deism, the God of popular American religion, not necessarily like a particular God of a particular religion, but a singular being who's all-knowing and all-powerful, created the world, is personal, is eternal, all the sort of qualities that people refer to when they talk about the God of Western civilization. And there's two possibilities: believe or don't believe. And so here, infinite gain if you believe there is a God. Infinite loss if you believe, if you don't believe and there is a God. The break even if you don't believe and there isn't a God. And then here, you get finite gain. You win some. Yeah.
But not everyone that believes in God or some sort of religion is 100% good, so necessarily they could go to hell. And so there is not necessarily finite gain because some people just unfortunately do bad things. So.
Well, the finite gain is that there isn't a God, so you don't get eternal life. But
yeah.
The idea is that you become a better person. But you're
saying that, you're not necessarily a good person just because you believe in something.
Okay, hold that thought for just a minute. I just want you to see the argument that believing in God is a bet you can't lose. Somebody tell me, why is believing in God a bet you can't lose according to Pascal? Yeah, Olive.
You won't have infinite loss in any situation except if you don't believe in God does exist. So
the worst
three out of four chances is going to be okay for you if you believe in God.
Yeah, so there's two choices. What's the best you can do if you're an atheist, according to Pascal?
Break even.
Who would want that bet, right? What's the worst you can do if you believe?
Have your own personal gain, even if it's not infinite gain.
Yeah, so you're gonna win. You're either gonna get the jackpot or you're gonna win something. If you had if there was a lottery on campus and they said, okay, a campus lottery, and this lottery, it doesn't cost anything to enter, and just for entering, we'll give you a dollar.
What do I have to do to enter? Just tell me your name. I'm like, you're not going to put me on any mailing list or anything. Oh, no, we don't even want an email address or a phone. Just give me your name, and we'll send it to your office door. We'll send you a dollar. But there's also a chance you could win $1 million. Well, who wouldn't do that? Or what if they're going to offer me $10 or $20? Of course, I'll take a free $20. So it's like Pascal saying, believing as God is like God handing a free $20 bill and saying, enter to win, and you might win like $100 zillion. But at least you're going to get the 20 spot. Well, that's a bet you can't lose, right? Why wouldn't you do that? And then think about, like, suppose there's another lottery on campus. It's the, I think about this, so what would be the lottery? It's the Communist Student Union. The Communist Student Union says, comrade, come enter our lottery. And then you say, oh, how much does it cost to enter? It costs $100 to enter, but we promise you'll get the $100 back in services from the collective. And you're like, okay, well, what is the collective going to do? Oh, you know, we haven't figured that out yet, but we'd like your money anyway. Okay, and then what do I win if? If there's a revolution, since you're a college professor and you wear eyeglasses, you'll probably be killed, right? Why would I ever enter that lottery, right? I'm probably going to be out $100. I'm probably not going to get my money back. And then if they succeed with their goal and have their communist revolution, I'll be killed as a counter-revolutionary. That would be ridiculous. I would never want to enter that lottery. So the idea is that this is a bet you can't lose. Now, criticism. So take these in order. Let's see. What's your name again?
Kristen.
So Kristen has this argument, and she says, I asked, is there a choice between God exists and that God doesn't exist? And you say, well, maybe there are many gods. Well, you know, which God or gods? You know, there's a lot of them. Which religion? And so you have like a bunch of major world religions, right? And then within those religions, you have all these different sects, too. And so, but you get the Catholics, and you get the Protestants. And then you have like this splinter groups like the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses, right? And then, and for every religion, this is true. And then the Protestants are all these different Protestant denominations. And you got the Seventh-day Adventists. I don't know where they fit in there. I guess they're a sort of a Protestant denomination. And then, okay, you think, okay, well, that's just the Christians, right? And then the Jews, and you're going to be Reformed or Orthodox or Reconstructionist, you know. And then you got your Hindus and your Buddhists and the Shinto. And then you got all these small religions like the Sikhs and the Jains and the Scientologists.
Taoist,
right? Taoism is actually a really big one. Right, so how are you going to know which one? That crosstalk over there is a little distracting. Guy in the green shirt, whose name I don't know. Yeah, could you distract him? And it's good for you if you're going to be in class to focus your attention to what's going on. So, where are we at? So which sect? So yeah, how do you figure it out?
Well, you first of all cancel the ones that don't necessarily believe.
But why would you? What reason would you have to do that, though? I mean, Pascal might say, "Oh, just become a Catholic." But then, what? You're not talking about betting anymore. You're talking about proof. You have to prove the Catholic Church is the one true church. And you know, it's pretty painful when you have like you're talking to a Catholic and they're trying to show apostolic succession goes back to the Apostle Peter. And they're like, look, Peter is the rock on which the church was built. And you say, well, look, in the book of Acts, it looks like James is running the show and the church is being run out of Jerusalem. Wasn't Christianity, like, didn't start as a Jewish sect and James is sort of the de facto leader? And then after a while, it looks like Paul's sort of running the show, right? And Peter, you don't hear much from him. And why is it that Paul wrote most of the New Testament? And why is it that Paul and Peter have this confrontation and Peter backs down and defers to Paul? It doesn't seem like, does anybody ever call Peter the Pope? You know, Pope doesn't come around until like Gregory or something. It's like way down the line. So but then you have to give arguments, right? You have to prove that your religion is a true one, and that's kind of tough. So you have to figure out, because every religious person is an atheist with regard to other people's gods, right? So the Christian says that all these, like, say, the gods of the pagan religions, like, say, Taoism. Like, if you look at Taoism, not the Taoism of Lao Tzu, but Taoism is the name of the popular religion of China, where they worship a kind of a pantheon of gods and goddesses. They'll say, oh, those are pagan gods. They don't really exist. And then the Taoists, they might accept the Christian God as existing, but he's one among many. Or they might say he doesn't exist. Right? So this is a big question. It's not as simple as, oh, believe in God or don't believe in God. You have to figure out which is a true religion. And you know, Christianity says, if you don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, Savior of mankind, you'll die in your sins and God's going to send you to hell. And in Islam, it says if you deny the Prophet Muhammad and his message, God's going to send you to hell. Eastern religions are kinder and gentler, and they say, oh, well, you'll just like be reincarnated in a lower station if you don't really get it, and you'll get to try again or something like that. But it's not as simple as just sort of believing in God or not believing in God. And then you raised an interesting question. What's your name again?
Cole.
Cole?
Cole.
So Cole raised an interesting question or issue, which is that many people believe in God, who believe in God probably deserve to go to hell. That religious belief, is not a guarantee of either morality, you know, or heaven, right? So all religious people are not good people, and all religious people aren't necessarily going to heaven, even if they believe in the right God. So you might believe in the right God, but you might do a bunch of stuff, and God's going to punish you anyway. Now, in Christianity, as long as you believe in Jesus and sincerely believe in him, that he died for your sins, you're going to be forgiven. You'll get to go to heaven. And I guess the idea there is, you know, what happens if you go out and commit a bunch of sins? And I guess the idea is that if you're going around sinning it up, you don't really believe in Jesus. You're just sort of paying lip service or something.
Unless you absolve and you go confess. That's the whole thing.
Unless you're Lutheran, in which case predestination, whether you believe in God or not, determines whether you're going to hell or heaven.
Well, there you go. So there's a predestination thing that makes things even more complicated, right?
That's not Catholicism.
Right. But if you... So in Catholicism, you had to go to a confession or a priest, and he'll absolve you of your sins.
But you also have to believe in transubstantiation, and you have to believe in the Trinity in order to go to heaven, and believe in God himself.
Yeah, I suppose... I'm not sure about the transubstantiation. I think you might... I mean, you could be a heretic on that and still be okay as long as you believe in Jesus. But there is sort of an issue, I guess, of like a person who is a Catholic who goes around committing a bunch of sins. And even if the person goes to the priest, I mean, there's been priests who've been arrested, like in the priest pedophile scandals. And not just the ones that commit the acts against children, but like the higher echelon leadership who are like shuffling around priests accused of molesting boys and then shuffling them off to another parish and try to cover it up. And you know, I think about like what's God going to do with that guy? And the Catholic Church is a little iffy on salvation by grace through faith too. I think they want to add on good works to it, and it's not like the Protestants where you can sort of be saved. It's like you got to do stuff too. I don't know. So, but that gets into the intricacies of Christian theology. Still, there's no guarantee just because you're a religious person that you're going to heaven.
Think about like the Muslims that flew the planes into the trade towers on 9/11. Is God going to send them to heaven? I would guess not. I would guess if there is a God and there is a hell, that they would be prime candidates for it. Other objections? Or maybe, defenses of this? Yeah.
Well, I have another objection. I think that gain that he says, like, I think that it could be also be a loss. Like, okay. If you don't believe, so if you believe in God and he doesn't exist, and you wasted every Sunday of your life, like, you know, I don't know, there's just, like, a lot of sacrifice you make for that religion, and then it doesn't pay off. So, I mean, does the gain outweigh the sacrifice always?
Yeah, so think about most religions tell you that you need to be a good person, and that means doing a lot of stuff for other people. That means not just like, you know, so there's the wasted time, you know, praying to non-existent being. And maybe you get something out of it, you get some warm, fuzzy feelings or something, but you think about it, you could have been out there doing something that was actually effective instead of praying for things. And then when things go your way, you're like, all right, God answered my prayer. And then when things don't go your way, you say, ooh, the Lord works in mysterious ways. And so that there it's sort of, but you could have been actually maybe doing something about your problem instead of asking God to help you out. Most religions require sort of certain degrees of asceticism, which, you know,
what is it? Can you define that?
So, asceticism means giving up bodily pleasures for spiritual purpose. So giving up
fasting.
Yeah, things like not eating for long periods of time, fasting. It means like a celibacy, not having sex, or it might mean monogamy, only having sex with one person that you're married to. Or it might mean not going out and getting drunk on the weekends, which, you know, was, or not smoking weed. It may mean, or not, you know, taking X and dancing under the laser lights or whatever, you know, people like to do these days. Not enjoying like a really good dirty joke, right? Think about like all the fun sins out there, right? Which involve like things like sex and drugs and rock and roll and drinking and
violence.
Sort of all the what's that?
And violence.
Violence, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. Like it's like somebody insults you and then you have to say I love you, brother, right? Or Christ forgives you. So they're like, yeah, what? Like this, you know, Jesus says, I mean, especially if you're a Christian, Jesus says if somebody offends you, you're supposed to turn the other cheek. And he also says if somebody asks for your coat, you should give them the shirt off your back. And he says anyone who wants to be my follower has to take up his cross and follow me. Well, cross is an instrument of death. The idea is you have to die to your own desires and pleasures and goals in life and put God first. That's a big sacrifice, right? Jesus even said that if you didn't hate your own father and mother for his sake, that you weren't worthy of him. So that's a lot to ask of a person, right? Now, if you're just sort of like a mamby-pamby Christian and you don't take any of that stuff seriously, well, then the question is God really going to take you to heaven or not?
This might have been covered by number three, but like, I just remember those parents that are religious of some sort that were praying for their child's disease to go away instead of actually taking them to a hospital to get treatment. So I think that would be like wasted time praying to non-existent, and then like even loss too, because
right.
The child died in the end, and then they even went to and had criminal charges against them too for neglecting the child. I think this happened a couple of times.
Yeah,
that's one of the problems.
It's a like a sect of a certain religion that just doesn't believe in.
So this is a Christian Science.
Yes,
I think
Christian Science.
You believe if you just pray to God, it'll help you.
Yeah, every couple of years there's some Christian Science couple and they have some child who has the diabetes, like not the type 2 that you get from drinking, you know, lots of soda and sugar and fatty foods over the lifetime. Middle age, you get type 2 diabetes, and you know, have to you know, order your diabetes supplies from Wilford Brimley from an infomercial. But the childhood diabetes is a genetic disorder that you get when you're young, and so you have to get like an insulin shot. And you get parents who think, oh well, our religion tells us that we should treat this through, you know, faith, for through faith, through healing, faith healing and prayer. And then the kid ends up dying, and then they end up going to prison for murder, negligent homicide. So yeah, so there might be some. It's going back to W. Clay Clifford, right? If you have faith in something that you don't have sufficient evidence for, you might end up doing something silly, or maybe you go off to, you know, Jonestown and drink the Kool-Aid or what have you. You join what's his name? So religion's got all sorts of pitfalls. If you join up with the wrong religion, you know, you could have all sorts of bad things happen. And even the good religions ask a lot of you. Plus, you know, they pass the plate, you're expected to put some money in it, right? So there's the financial bit, too. Yes, Cole.
So, like, this is kind of like a general question, but, like, most religions, they do kind of, like, ask for you to sacrifice those, like, human desires, kind of.
Yeah, just about all of them. Even, you know, people think, oh, the Eastern religions, I can kind of do what I want. But the Eastern religions are even worse because they say, what's your problem? Your problem is desire. Desire is tying you to the earthly plane. So what do you need to do? Beat back all those earthly desires. I mean, in India, they still have arranged marriages. You know, the idea of, like, hooking up, you know, when you're young is not a popular thing. It's because there's a culture of asceticism there. Now, it's gradually changing as society becomes more secular. And then you get people that kind of cheat in their religion. They have this idea, well, like the sort of new Hindu view of things is that you sort of go through stages of life and you don't give up your desires until you're sort of old and they're waning anyway. So that's kind of like, that's what will probably be peddled to you in your religion class. And that's kind of what, the way a lot of Hindus get around it today, as they say, well, all this aesthetic stuff, but, you know, all this sort of sitting alone in your own room and meditating, that you do that at the end of your life and you're about to croak anyway. So, but yeah, lots of sacrifices. Buddhism says desire is the cause of suffering. And so you should try to whittle down those desires as little as possible. So yeah, lots of sacrifices. So I think Pascal underplays the sacrifices required in religious life. Now, what would he say? Well, he would say you're getting all this stuff back, right? So you're getting, you know, feeling good about, instead of thinking, oh, you know, I could die at any moment and I'll be food for the worms and my consciousness will be obliterated. And everyone I've ever known who's died is gone forever. You know, those are kind of depressing thoughts, right?
No.
No? You don't think so?
No, I'm
kidding. Okay. Some people, I don't care. So you think about, like, if you're a religious person, you think you're going to see, you know, your loved ones who've died. And you have a hope that even though you might get killed in a car crash on the way home today, you will live on. Your soul is going to be going to heaven. And that's a, you know, that's a comfort. And this is why religious people overall live longer, happier, better adjusted lives. They have marriages that last longer. They have more healthy relationships. They're psychologically better off. And they report having happier and more fulfilling lives. You look at the atheists, they tend to be screwed up people. Particularly people who are really militant about it. Like the really hardcore atheists, they tend to have psychological problems. They often commit suicide. They have troubled relationships, and they end up dying earlier than their religious counterparts. So maybe God's trying to tell you something. Other criticisms. So I mean, this might be, you know, in favor of Pascal. I'll put this over here on the sort of side.
pro-Pascal. As studies show that religious people are happier, healthier, have better relationships.
Look at Woody Allen. He's terrified of everything.
Yeah, and, you know, why wouldn't you be sort of like Woody if you're an atheist? I think he is an atheist, I would guess.
Yeah, he's...
like a secular Jew or something. I mean, he's like, he's Jewish ethnically, but I'm pretty sure that he's an
all
atheist
the
or not.
Are just like, why should I believe in God? And then he's just like freaking out about it.
I think he's an existential, atheistic existentialist or something. There's actually a funny bit in Take the Money and Run where his parents are being interviewed, and as Virgil Downing is the name of the character, and he's like a petty thief, and the father is saying, "That kid was a goddamn atheist. I tried to beat God into him, but he would never listen." And so I think some of his beliefs about God are sort of coming out there. Better relationships. What else did I miss in here?
A longer life.
I mean, those are major markers of human well-being, right? So, and this doesn't mean that every person who believes in God has these qualities in their life, or that every atheist is a basket case. But, you know, overall, if you look at large numbers of people, people who have not just a belief in God, but like an active religious faith, seem to be doing better than the rest of us, or those without believing in God. But, you know, again, it's, you have to get, you give up a lot of stuff too. You know, internet porn, think of all the things which you think, oh, God probably wouldn't approve of that. Right? Think about like having like more than one love interest is forbidden in most religions. Gambling, you like going to Vegas and you know blowing a couple $100 and catch like a topless review. No. Going out getting drunk and staggering down the strip. Nope, not for you, right? Ordering up an alcohol massage. Oh, God's going to take a dim view of that. And so think about other things like enjoying a trashy romance novel. That might be off limits. So it's not just necessarily the big sins, but even the little sins, or even like being a little too selfish, or gossiping about your neighbor. I mean, those are sins in the Bible too. And Jesus said it's not just adultery, but even if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery in your heart, and that's enough to send you to hell right there. So there's a lot of a lot of sacrifice. How about other arguments? You got which religion, which God, that religious people aren't necessarily better than other people. Like maybe, there's a lot of religious people in prison. If you did a survey of people in prison, the majority of them believe in God, maybe even more than the general population. They tend not to be religious people, so even though they espouse belief in God, that might just be because the majority of people espouse belief in God. Although a lot of them get religion once they get into prison.
Yeah.
And why do they show up at chapel? Well, you get a chance to get out of your cell. So that's probably why. Other arguments against Pascal's wager?
Seems like there's one more here.
I can think of one. Will God reward spiritual gamblers? Right. Speaking of gambling, why this is called the wager? You could call it, in today you call it the bet, right? Pascal is saying you can't figure out intellectually whether God exists, so bet on God anyway because it's going to be good for you. Well, that seems like a kind of a cynical view, don't you think? Isn't that sort of like fire insurance?
You're saying believing God is a kind of insurance to avoid going to hell? Or to, you know, get something out of God if he does exist? So it does seem sort of a cynical view. And is God really going to reward that? And then a counterpart in this, will God punish those who sincerely disbelieve? Sincerely and honestly disbelieve. Or don't believe. You don't necessarily have to have a positive disbelief. But those who don't believe. It seems like that would be, sort of an unjust God who would punish people for having a sincere and honest lack of belief. Suppose they investigated all the evidence for God. Maybe they even went to grad school in philosophy, trying to find out whether there was a God or not. And after they got through, they said, there's no evidence for God, and so I'll be an agnostic. The famous philosopher Bertrand Russell once said that he was asked in an interview, as a television interview, he was asked, if it turns out that you're wrong and you die and find yourself in the presence of God, what will you say to him? And his answer was, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence. And wouldn't that have to shake out, right, if there really wasn't enough evidence for a rational person to believe in it? So to believe in him, would that really be fair for God to send old Bertie to hell? Yeah.
Didn't God not want us to have like rational thoughts? Isn't that the whole like, Satan and the snake giving Adam and Eve the apple?
Well, first of all, it wasn't an apple in the story, but that was more about like disobeying God, I think, than that it wasn't like this idea they're supposed to have faith. I think they're supposed to trust God, I suppose. I mean, if you look at the Bible, it's kind of a mixed bag, and there's a lot of talk about belief and evidence. But think about this: like, so Christianity is just one of many beliefs, right? So you find yourself plunked in the middle of multicultural Eugene. You get a Sikh living down the street. There's some Jehovah's Witnesses that bother you when you're in the shower on occasion. You come to the door wrapped in a towel, and they want to tell you about the coming Armageddon. There's the Mormon missionaries and a nice starch fight church come by with their little name tags and talk to you at the door about Moroni. And then there's your friend the Baptist, and then you're in a class, and there's you're taking like a cultural diversity class, and you show up at this party at the multicultural center, and you meet like a Hindu, a Buddhist, and a Muslim, and you're wondering, okay, well that's a lot of religions, and I don't want to be biased, even though I've lived in America, and most people are Christians. If I were born in India, most people would be Hindus. If I was in China and Japan, most people would be Buddhists. So I want to give each religion a fair shake. Well, that's a lot of footwork. And how are you supposed to know which guy is the right one? And then what are you going to do? Pick the one who offers like the biggest threats? Like, oh, Christianity, God's going to send you to fiery pit to burn forever and ever. Maybe I'll join that one, because if I piss that God off, he's going to do the worst to me. Hinduism, the worst will happen, I'll be reincarnated as a rat or something. So maybe I'll go with that one. That seems like a kind of a funny way to pick a religion. Yeah.
Oh, this is a really random question, but I was just wondering, like, where's C.G. Young? Like, what?
He's sort of a mystic, I guess.
Yeah, but is he like Christian? Or like a mystic?
I don't know that he was any particular religion. He tended to think religions are sort of all manifestations of some greater spiritual reality. And he was more Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. So, is God going to punish you for not believing? Well, if you're sincere, it seems like imagine I was going to give, because I said, okay, there's a pop quiz, right? I say pop quiz today.
and I tell you, this will make the difference between whether you pass the class or fail the class. And then I hand out this quiz, or maybe I just start writing stuff on the board. And the first question is, what's the capital of Assyria? Anybody know? Assyria, not Syria, but Assyria, the ancient land of Assyria, right? And then, and question number two, what's your favorite color? Question number three, what's the cruising speed of a swallow? And I'm like, list all these questions, and you're like, I don't know, I had no idea. I didn't know what to prepare for this exam, and if I didn't give you like any forewarning, and then, or suppose I were to say, I'm going to give you a pop quiz on Monday, there'll be 10 questions on it, and it's those 10 questions. And then the student says, since this test is like going to result in like our total course grade and replace everything we've ever done so far, what should we do to study? And I say, well, there's 100 study guides on my website, and I want you to look at all of them. And one of those 100 might have the right answer for you. And so I want you to study all of them and come to class and pick which study guide you think gives you the right answers and then take the test. Now suppose one person like gets a passing grade, say they get an A on it, and most people like flunk. Would that be a fair way of doing things? That seems like it would be pretty unfair, right? Because there's no way for you to know what the right answers are. Well, it's the same thing with God, right? How are you supposed to know which religion is the right religion? How are you supposed to know what God wants, or if any of them are, or what God wants you to do? There's no way to tell. Or at least if you could tell, it's going to take you a long time to sort of, figure it out. Okay, so that's probably enough on Pascal's wager. Any final thoughts? Let's talk about Kierkegaard then. So what's somebody want to sum up? What's Kierkegaard's main point? How does he compare with somebody like William James or W.K. Clifford? What's he all about? Oh, I think my board captures. Any thoughts? If someone were to say, "What's this sort of?" Suppose you're at a cocktail party, and someone says, "So you're in the philosophy class. Don't you talk about that Soren Kierkegaard fellow? What's he all about? It's been a while since I've been in college. Something about existentialism. What's that? Well, what would you say to him or her?" And just speak out as soon as something comes to your fertile mind. No thoughts?
Well, he poses two questions, or two problems. An objective problem, which is Christianity true? And then a subjective problem, which is what is our individual relationship to Christianity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so is Christianity true? And what's his like analysis? Does he give like a bunch of proofs for Christianity? Does he like refer to try to establish how the Bible is the Word of God and how it contains all and only those books that belong in it, and how there aren't any books that got left out, and how there aren't any that are in there that shouldn't be in there? I think Martin Luther wanted to kick out the book of James. He didn't like what I had to say about faith and works, and he was like, "Oh, I think this book probably doesn't belong in the canon." Early on, there was all these books. There were all these other books floating around, the Shepherd of Hermes, the Teaching of the Twelve, and there was some debate about whether they belonged in there or not. But the Gospel of Thomas that popped up in the 40s. Actually, I think it came up earlier. They have found all these early Christian writings in the 40s at Nag Hammadi in Egypt. So, I mean, there's all these problems with, like, the Bible. But what does Kierkegaard say about that? Anybody remember? What does he say about this idea of sort of trying to analyze the Bible and prove the Bible's the Word of God and try to explain, like, all the biblical contradictions? You know, if you have, like, a contradiction in the Bible, to try to explain why it's not really a contradiction. Do you think that's a worthwhile task?
No.
Yeah, so why not?
Because either you're one of two people. You either already have faith and are convinced, or you are researching it objectively, in which case you are not in a condition to be infinitely interested in the subject matter.
Yeah, so the more you detach yourself from something, the less it means something to you. So if you're going to be objective and study it, that means being dispassionate, and that means really not being a Christian anymore. Whereas if you're really interested in it and you're looking at it from the standpoint of faith, that means that you're not being objective anymore.
So does Kierkegaard try to do that? Try to prove the Bible?
No, he says you shouldn't waste your time doing that. He says, even if all the dreams of the theologians are fulfilled, that we've proved all those books which are in the Bible are inspired by God, there aren't any books that should have been in there that aren't in there, and there aren't any books that got in there that shouldn't be in there, and that all the supposed contradictions in the Bible can be explained to any rational person's satisfaction.
So does he then...
He says, well, if you imagine all those things are true, he says, like, what have you accomplished? Not a damn thing. Why? Because nobody who didn't already believe is going to believe, and the people who already believe, they already believe, and their faith isn't going to be increased anymore. You don't increase a person's faith by giving them more proof for what they already believe. So you really haven't heard, you haven't made anybody who's a skeptic believe, and you haven't made anyone who already believes any better off. And his idea is you're never going to convince a person to believe through evidence. It has to be a leap of faith. And so he thinks that...
For everything he believes that?
He says it's just for Christianity.
Okay.
And that's actually a good question. Like, why only apply this to religion? Why should you take a leap of faith in religion and not give some other belief system, like existentialism, or
is he an existentialist?
Actually, he is an existentialist. So, you know, communism. Oh yeah. I mean, you look at the history of mankind, this idea of a collective, you know, mob sort of running a society and having anything good happen is, I think, you know, Christianity is better off, because at least, you know, with communism, there's so much argument, there's so much obvious empirical arguments against it, that it, you know, you have to sort of be totally ignorant of history, or actually, you know, be in denial. Whereas with Christianity, there's a lot of stuff that's unfalsifiable, where you can't even have any evidence one way or the other. And so they'll say, well, just have faith in it. So the difference between something which is easily disprovable and has been disproved, as opposed to something which is sort of theoretical and otherworldly and maybe has a lot of problems with thinking, well, what would be proof for it? So that's probably a side issue, but the main argument is why belief in Christianity? Why does it get passed?
That's like
evidence?
The argument against his beliefs, because isn't that what Kierkegaard believes? He believes that that's just for Christianity, and then everything else you still need proof for.
Right.
Okay.
So
that's right.
Kierkegaard. So, Christian, I introduce a word here, apologetics, which is reasons or arguments to prove Christianity is true. is a waste of time. And again, he thinks no skeptic will be convinced. And no believer will be convinced, you know, because he already believes. Or better off. So what do you think of, what do you think about this as a general argument? Let's take apart this. Why believe in Christianity? Why not believe in something else? This, how about this argument about the nature of religious belief? Like I was at a debate. This is when I was first starting graduate school. Actually, this is when I first started at UC Santa Barbara. It's in 1990, and there was a debate between a Christian and an atheist, and they were both philosophers. And who was that? It was William Lane Craig and the atheist guy. I think it was like Paul Crutz or something like that. So these two well-established philosophers. And the debate was, did Jesus rise from the dead? And the argument from William Lane Craig is that the resurrection of Jesus was a historical fact, that there's sufficient evidence to prove that Jesus did in fact rise from the dead, and that central claim of Christianity is true. The atheist gave a skeptical argument against the idea that Jesus rose from the dead, and said there's lots of reasons to believe that it didn't happen that way. So at the end, do you think that anybody who went to this talk that they changed their mind about whether Jesus rose from the dead or not?
No.
And why would you say no?
Because that belief, if we're going to speak, I'll speak in James's terms because I really agree with it, is like living for those people. And they already have their belief system set in their minds for their personal lives. So no matter what other people say, sure, they might take it in and understand the other person's arguments against Christianity, but in their personal lives, it's highly doubtful that they would change their belief system just upon what another human being is saying.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? Seem convincing. Even if you're a skeptic, might you agree with Kierkegaard here?
Yeah.
That people have religious beliefs aren't likely to change them based on reason and evidence. Like some skeptics actually say, yeah, it's true that religion is all a matter of blind faith, and you really can't reason with religious people. So interestingly, they'll say, yes, I agree with Kierkegaard that evidence is worthless in religious discussions, but they'll go on to say, and that's why religion is a bunch of hooey. That's why religion is all a bunch of nonsense, because it's not based on any evidence.
I think it goes back to the whole belief systems being relative argument.
Oh no, relativism, the ghost of relativism is haunting us again.
That's what I feel like. I feel that Kierkegaard is just merely emphasizing the fact that each individual will have his or her own belief system regardless of what others believe.
He does say these things like subjectivity is truth, right? Which makes it sound very relativistic. That's like one of the headings. He says, subjectivity is truth. But by subjectivity, he's not saying truth is subjective. He's saying subjectivity is truth. I look at that and thinking, well, maybe I should learn Danish to figure out what Kierkegaard meant by that. But I think it's probably just, this is probably a little reading Danish, isn't it? He's just using language in a funny way. What is this? I think what he means by this, though, is that
in order, there's more to just having intellectual beliefs. You have to have a passionate commitment to something. And to really believe in something means not just to intellectualize it, but to have it be a part of your life, to act on it. So I think that's what he means when he says subjectivity is true.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, that it means to really believe in something. To really believe means to be passionately committed. Passionately, subjectively committed to something. Not to just say, oh, I believe X. You're going back to the book of James. The book of James says, you say you believe, well, even the demons believe and shudder. So he's the author of the book of James, supposed to be James, the brother of Jesus, says, look, the demons recognize that Jesus is the Son of God. They believe that just the same way that you do. But, you know, are they serving him as their Lord and Master? No, they're serving Satan. And so there's more to just intellectual belief. That to believe in the fullest sense means to commit your life to something. Like, if you say, you know, somebody might say to me, Bardale, what do you believe in? I might say, I believe in liberty, right? And they'll say, well, what do you mean by that? And I would say, well, you know, I believe in the proposition that all men are created equal or something, that human beings, that the best society is one which is organized around voluntary cooperation. And that is something I believe intellectually. But also, you know, I do things in my life where I live my life in a free way, and I try to encourage others to do the same. And I'm active politically. And whenever some new insult to my liberties comes down the pike, I'm out there, you know, pounding my fist on the lectern at the city council, or writing a letter to my congressman, or what have you. So, and if I just, and someone says, well, what does that mean to you? And it's like, oh, I just have this belief, like, you know, every Christmas I read Thomas Paine or something like that. You wonder whether I really believe in it. To believe in something means to be passionately committed to the idea. So, in the same way, Kierkegaard would say, God's not a proposition, God is a person. And to be related to God in the right way doesn't mean to study him like you'd study a specimen in a biology class. It means to trust him, to have a relationship with him. And that requires you to put aside objectivity and make a passionate commitment to serving God. And you can't do that if you intellectualize God and make it into an object instead of a subject. So another thing, you might can't treat God as an object. But you have to treat him as a person. Like, imagine, you know, you're you come home to your significant other. Maybe you enjoy a marital bond. Maybe you're shacking up and living in sin. And you come home and your significant other says, you know, honey, I was thinking today how lucky I am to have you and how much I love you. And you say, oh, yeah? Well, what's your evidence for that? prove to me that you love me, right? Hey, you get slapped, or you all of a sudden you're thinking, you know what, I was totally wrong, you're a bastard, you know, or something like that. They get all upset at you. And so you don't relate to a person that you love as an object, and you don't constantly require evidence of their love, you just accept it. And Kierkegaard says that's how our relationship with God should be. We shouldn't continually demand proof of God and proof that he's real. We should relate to him as a subject rather than an object. So what do you think about this as an idea? As a proposition for how you have to live your life, or as a, I don't want to say proposition that makes it sound intellectual, but the idea that if, when you're thinking about religion, that you can't treat God as an object for study, that you have to treat God as a subject.
I think it makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think that if everyone treated God as an object, there would be no sincere belief, but rather just a constant search and discovery for proof and reasoning, and it would completely distance those religious people from actually believing, but rather just on a search for proof all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Isn't that what makes it faith instead of science?
Yeah. Exactly.
Is that small bridge you have to gap without fully understanding?
Yeah, I think Kierkegaard would agree with that. But then what, I'll put this as a form of objection, why God?
Why only God?
You know, why only God? So he says that you should take this passionate commitment. Well, why not trust in, you know, science, anarchy, the coming revolution, or whatever? You think about the things that people believe in. Art. Some people, their art is a religion. Or music of a certain kind, or despair, embrace despair and pain. You know, go back to like those death metal cutters or what have you. This idea you should take a leap of faith, but the idea is in which direction? And again, what religion? Okay, Kierkegaard says Christianity. Well, he grew up in Denmark. That's the religion that most people have is Protestant Christianity. Why not Catholicism? Well, it's just an accident of birth that Kierkegaard was born in Denmark, right? Could have been someplace else. So that's that might be a criticism of him. Why only God, and then, you know, getting this which God problem, if you're going to say it's going to be God. There is something I think right about Kierkegaard, though, which is he raises this issue that it seems like there's this conflict between having an objective belief in something and being passionately committed. So, objective knowledge versus passionate commitment. And it seems like these two things are at odds with each other. Do you think of a case where there might be a conflict here, where on the one hand you want to be objective, and so you need to be impartial, fair, dispassionate, and then if you have a passionate commitment, this means you're going to be active, you're going to be doing things, you're going to be biased, right? You're going to be what's another word for biased? I'll just leave it there. Partial, right? Instead of being impartial, you're partial. Here you're impartial. Can you think of a case where, like, you might, in everyday life, where you might run this conflict in a certain job or situation?
Like, you...
Wait, is this objective knowledge and subjective?
Yeah.
Kristen.
So I work for the state, for the office of the governor, so, like, I'm not really allowed to say or act in a way professionally against him. Like, I have to, like, uh-huh. be like, oh, okay, Governor Kitzhaber is the best.
You're working for the man like everybody else in the state. So am I, right? I'm a state employee. Yeah, so even though you might have like personal views about the governor's policies, since you're working for him, you have to sort of keep your personal beliefs out of it, right? Yeah, that's a good example. Also, like, think about, so if you're like a journalist, for example, this is where it comes up a lot. Like, so if you're like not an opinion reporter, but you're like a straight reporter, you do a straight news story, people expect you to use objective detachment. And so you have to put your personal beliefs aside and just, you know, report the facts and not cherry pick the facts that are going to make your story sort of support your personal political beliefs. Now, in theory, that's what you're supposed to do as a journalist. In fact, it usually turns out that people are biased, just not as much as on the editorial page. So,
journalism. I'll put
government work.
Where you disagree with policy. Like, there's all kinds of things about LCC that I disagree with. Now, as a professor, I can spout off and not have to worry about it. But there's all sorts of institutional commitments that the college has that I think are just awful. But, you know, I got the... Paradoxically, I have the union protecting me. So, in journalism, you're supposed to be objective. And so you're reporting the facts. And so there's the objective knowledge. But as a reporter, you might also have personal commitments and views about like the topics you're covering. Suppose you're covering like the latest shooting, right? And maybe you have a particular view about gun control, which is really people control, because you know the guns don't shoot themselves. So you might have an issue about whether people ought to own guns or not, or what kinds of guns they ought to have. But if you're doing a journalistic piece, you're being a reporter, you're expected to just give the facts in the case, even if they seem to be against your view, even if they make your view look like it's got some problems with it. And that's a tough thing to do. Also think about like things like science is another good example. Like if you're doing scientific research, suppose you're doing like a, when you're doing work on, like, say, researching global warming and you're at the University of East Anglia and you're worried about like your critics actually making a case, and what do you do? Well, it turns out that the researchers, they destroyed a bunch of evidence. There's emails going back and forth about trying to like cook the data to get it to support their view, so people would keep on believing global warming, even though the evidence really didn't look like it was there anymore. It looked like the planet was actually cooling over the last 10 or 15 years. And so what the scientists did to create public uproar was that they let their personal bias affect their knowledge. But what are these people thinking? Oh, well, what's the most important is that people believe in global warming. We have global carbon taxes and curtail industrial pollution, and we're all going to die. So they're fighting for the cause. But to the degree you're fighting for the cause, you're not checking the evidence to make sure you're fighting for the right cause. And this is always this dance back and forth between making sure you have the facts and then being able to act in the world, right? Because you never have 100% knowledge, 100% evidence. And so you're always acting with some element of doubt. And so there's always this sort of back and forth between what does the evidence show? But then it's like, what am I going to do today? And if you always waited until you were 100% certain of anything, you would never be able to do anything in life, right? So you need to... I think so. Kierkegaard's point that there's a difference between these two, and there's a tension between having objective knowledge of the world and having passionate commitments you can act on, is something you have to consider when you're thinking of acting in the world. So that's all we have time for today. Next week, David Hume on miracles and our general discussion of religious knowledge.